Hello, welcome to ID the Future. I'm Mike Keyes, and today I have with me Paul Nilsson, and we're going to talk about a brand new book and his part in that book project. Welcome, Paul, to ID the Future.
Thanks very much for having me.
So this book, it's a big one at that, called Theistic Evolution, a Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique. Sounds like it has three major parts. Which part or parts did you contribute to?
I'm in the science section and also in the philosophy section. I have two chapters in the science section. One of them is a chapter that I wrote myself. The other is co-authored with Ann Gager and Steve Meyer. And then Steve and I co-authored a chapter in the philosophy section dealing with the idea of methodological naturalism. So I'm very happy to be in the book. I think it's a wonderful textbook, really, on this topic of theistic evolution.
Great. Now, let's talk about your first essay, the one called Five Questions Everyone Should Ask About Common Descent, which is in the first section of the book called The Scientific Critique of Theistic Evolution. So I've read the essay, love it, and I like the way you set up the reader to even understand the importance of the five questions that you later introduce. Why talk about sort of fundamental questions about common descent as part of a scientific critique of theistic evolution? What place does your chapter have in this section of the book?
Within the larger project of thinking about and critiquing theistic evolution, one of the standard claims on the table is that Darwin's theory of common descent, understood to mean all life on planet Earth traces its ancestry to a common ancestor that lived in the remote past. In other words, this is our ultimate grandparent, in a sense, a cell, a single cell, sometime, you know, 3.2 or 3.3 billion years ago, that theory is simply not up for grabs. In other words, it's part of the furniture of reality. It's just the way the universe is. All, you know, that life on this planet all stemmed from that original source or cell, often called the last universal common ancestor, or abbreviated LUCA. And the case is made by theistic evolutionists, or by the biological community in general, although I'll note some exceptions in just a moment, that if you're properly educated, this history, this pattern of universal relatedness, is something that you have to accept. And whatever your views may be, whether you're a theist, whether you think there was some kind of design in the origin of biology, you must harmonize or integrate those views with this historical pattern of universal relatedness.
Must sounds pretty strong. Sounds like it's an invitation for a little resistance.
Well, it's must in the sense that I think an astronomer would say a student of astronomy must adopt as correct the view that our solar system is oriented around the sun, right? That the planets move around the sun, that this was discovered by Copernicus and Galileo, and it's bad faith. It's not reasonable. It's bad faith scientifically to throw that geometry of the solar system into question.
Right.
No professional astronomer gets up in the morning and looks at the sun coming up in the east and says, you know, I wonder if the sun's moving and this is an Earth-centered system. Or I wonder if Tycho Brahe was given the short end of the stick, you know, a few centuries ago when the Copernican geometry was adopted. For a working biologist, they say, look, it's just not reasonable to question the universal relatedness of life. All the evidence indicates this, so get with the program. And I was educated in that view. I went at University of Pittsburgh as an undergraduate, studied evolutionary biology from 1980 to 1984, and then on to graduate school. And not really until I was just about ready to defend my dissertation in the mid-90s was there really any question among leading evolutionary biologists that that geometry might be wrong. So I think this happens in all sciences. There are core propositions that the student and the mature investigator takes as established.
Right. I mean, it's sort of a game. I mean, if you're going to play the game of science or a particular field of science, there are certain rules that most people tend to go by. And so you go with the program.
That's right. Rules and or propositions. Mm-hmm. Someone studying infectious disease must take as given or as established beyond reasonable doubt that there are agents that carry infection, viruses, bacteria, and so forth. That's the gateway into learning the science of infectious disease. The gateway into learning evolutionary theory or historical biology more generally was this claim: all living things on planet Earth are related by common descent from a single ancestor.
It served as a useful research program to at least get some, you know, some questions on the table that are worth pursuing?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it is a powerful model that has many consequences. The Ptolemaic Aristotelian geometry of the solar system was a powerful, even aesthetically elegant model for how the celestial bodies moved with relation to the Earth. It just happened not to be true. Analogously, I would say that this model of universal common ancestry provides a framework within which to understand biological evidence, and it would never have gained the broad acceptance that it still generally holds if it didn't have lots of things going for it, in its favor, so to speak. But one of the things I've said to my students over the years is we need, painful as it is, we need carefully to distinguish elegance and power from truth. When the Copernican system was first adopted, it was rather ungainly, right? It was like a gawky adolescent, a gawky child, really. We do not identify, we should not identify the usefulness, the attractiveness, even the aesthetic elegance of a theory with its truth. And so what's happened in the past two decades, largely as a consequence of automated DNA sequencing, is that an ocean of genomic and other types of data that no one anticipated have really challenged this single tree picture. So that's one of the things I explore in the chapter.
Great. So, all right. So you have, you explain the basic terms of the debate. You do a nice setup for these five questions, and then you begin to ask the tough questions. Let's just talk about one of those questions. And
okay.
Let the listener become a near future reader and find out what they all say. So pick one of your questions.
Well, the first question, even before I get to the questions,
sure.
In the chapter, what I do is I kind of lay out a little bit of the geography of the field and of the some of the relevant considerations, such as the term evolution and the term common descent are not synonyms. Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, the French evolutionist, pre-Darwinian evolutionist, did not think that all living things shared a common ancestor. Nonetheless, he was a fully confirmed evolutionist. Surprises many people to learn this, but Ernst Haeckel, the post-Darwinian German embryologist who gave us terms like ontogeny and phylogeny and the false but very powerful picture that development in animals recapitulates their evolutionary history. He did not accept common descent because he thought that spontaneous generation was occurring all the time throughout the history of life, and that the single-celled organisms we see today were not the lineal descendants of single-celled organisms in the distant past, but in fact had spontaneously generated in recent history, if you draw that out, you do not get a single tree picture. So that's one thing that people need to realize, is that common descent and evolution are not synonyms.
By the way, Paul, you know, one thing I really like about your work, coming also as a historian and philosopher of science, is you help us to remember some of the key figures of the past who thought of the world in a different way than maybe is taken as the default today. And then you can also find similar people today who hold these minority viewpoints. And so I think, I mean, I really like the way that you use the history of science to frame current debates about fundamental issues such as common descent.
I think it's very important for scientists in particular, who end up, as a consequence of their education, learning very little history of science, most of them, to know that their science has a history, and that questions that they think are unworthy of attention were thought very worthy of attention by some of their predecessors. For one thing, having this historical perspective gives you a certain amount of humility with respect to your own position. It helps to loosen up or bump you out of ruts, let's say, that you might otherwise be stuck in. So having done a bit of ground clearing in the opening of the chapter, then my first question I ask is, look, if common descent were not true, how would we know it? Now, you might think this is an easy question to answer, and in one sense, it is. You can imagine facts about the world that we don't see today. That if you saw them, you'd say, well, you know, if I saw the following, I would have reason to doubt common descent. And since Darwin's time, most evolutionary biologists have done this. And there's a kind of funny reason for that. The formulation of universal common descent, because it is a universal theory, in other words, it applies to every living thing on this planet, everything gets dumped in there, and you think, well, look, all the data that I see have already been dumped into the theory. How can anything possibly challenge it, since it's universally quantified? Well, what biologists have done is they said, well, I can imagine things. I can imagine observing, let's say, a variety of different genetic codes, or I can imagine observing mammals, mammalian fossils in Cambrian strata where they don't occur. Mammalian fossils occur very much later in the geological column and so forth. And they say, well, look, if I saw that, I would have reason to doubt common descent. So this use of what is known as counterfactual conditionals or conditional counterfactuals appears to provide empirical support to common descent, because we don't want to hold the theory as an axiom. That's one of the things I talk about in the chapter, right? Many biologists hold the theory as an axiom.
So by an axiom, you mean something that the investigator takes to be what?
Well, something that is a lens through which all the evidence is seen, but that is not itself ever in question. And this is very problematic for any science that claims to be empirical, because even a theory that we are absolutely convinced of, in other words, we think there's, you know, this theory really does all the work we want it to do, it fits with all the evidence in front of us, even very powerful and well-established theories like that in science, as opposed to logic or geometry or mathematics, still needs to be vulnerable to the testimony of nature. You still need to be able to test it, in other words, to say this, to specify the conditions under which the theory would be false. In other words, we might have made a mistake. Nature needs to be able to talk back to us and tell us, you know, you got it wrong.
So in other words, a vulnerable theory, if it's, you mean by that, testable, right?
And exactly.
It's a good thing, right? If what? If it's tested, and what happens?
Well, look, if it's tested and it survives the tests, then we have more reason to trust it, right?
Yeah.
And every theory in science is in the position of, or should be in the position of, let me express it normatively, of being potentially vulnerable to evidence. In other words, the if you think of it as a highway between us, we make theories. Nature doesn't provide them to us. We construct them.
Right.
The highway between our theories and nature herself needs to allow for traffic in both directions. So we develop theories, and those theories tell us, go out and look for the following, right? And that's why we develop theories. We want them as tools to lead to discovery, to lead to greater understanding.
Kind of like having a conversation with nature. It's a two-way street.
Exactly. It's a two-way street. And the traffic needs to be able to flow back to us from nature herself. She needs, if I can personify her, she needs to be able to tell us, you've misunderstood me here, and I'm going to send you a signal that tells you that you've misunderstood me, that you've made a mistake. And by via that signal coming back to you, that's actually how you can improve your theories. So there's a dialogue between the evidence and our theories. When it's working right, our theories get better because they are fixed to handle things they didn't explain, or we jettison them entirely, right? The phlogiston theory for combustion went out the window because it didn't work as well as a theory employing oxygen and so forth. Theories of noxious vapors for the origin of disease went out because infectious agents were much more powerful, and in fact the history of science is a record of discarded failed theories that couldn't withstand the rebuke of nature, if you will. They get shoved off the side of the road. In any case, comet descent itself, even though it's widely regarded as true and powerful and so forth, needs to be excuse me, vulnerable in that sense of being confronted with evidence. So the first question I ask is, look, if it wasn't true, how would we know it? And it turns out that Darwin himself understood this. In chapter 6 of The Origin of Species, a chapter that occurs more or less in the middle of the book, there are 14 chapters in The Origin in the first edition, so it's not quite in the middle, but Darwin was a really good rhetorician of science, and he understood that his readers at that point would have lots of questions, right? It's like someone in the back of the room is waving their arm, and rather than make that person wait until the end of the book before he fields their objections, Darwin very wisely puts in a chapter where he says, all right, let's consider some problems with these ideas that I've been, this theory that I've been sketching out for you.
And does he go and rescue his theory from those objections over and over?
Well, Darwin called himself a master wriggler, and he was able, he had all the rhetorical skill of Galileo in being able to take apparently crushing or fatal objections and neutralize them or provide reasons to think that those objections were not crushing or fatal. But in that chapter, and actually in his correspondence with Asa Gray at Harvard, a Christian who was a botanist at Harvard, a theistic evolutionist, albeit not in the modern sense of that term, one of the questions Darwin fielded from Gray and also considers in chapter 6 is, if it wasn't true, this theory of comet descent that I've developed, how would I know it? And Darwin says, look, I'll paraphrase. If we could observe any feature of a living thing that could not have been constructed by numerous successive slight steps, my theory would absolutely break down. Okay. Now, the adjectives don't matter. The steps don't have to be small. They could be large. So the grain or the increment of change is not the relevant logical consideration. Really what Darwin is saying is there must be some natural pathway connecting that feature that we're wondering about to the rest of life.
That sounds like what you identify as the principle of continuity in your essay.
That's what I name it, and that's what it's come to be named in evolutionary biology. Darwin himself didn't call it that, but this principle, which really says very, very simply, if you postulate that two species, two taxa, feature A and feature B, whatever it happens to be, are connected by some natural pathway of evolutionary change, then every point in that natural pathway must be biologically possible. Now, that may sound like a truism. In fact, it's very powerful. And once you become aware of this principle in evolutionary theory, excuse me, you will see it everywhere.
Yeah.
it really is everywhere, because it's a key tool that biologists use to adjudicate the plausibility of one another's of the adaptive or evolutionary scenarios that are out there. So, for instance, right now, there is a debate going on within evolutionary theory about the origin of cell organelles like mitochondria. Standard theory for several decades has been that the mitochondria in eukaryotic cells, these are the little power plants that we have in our cells that produce ATP, were originally free living cells from the alpha proteobacteria that were engulfed by some other cell that did not have a mitochondria. And in fact, they weren't mitochondria when they were first engulfed. They were bacterial cells. They were engulfed, set up shop, set up a fruitful symbiotic relationship with the host, the cell that engulfed them. It didn't digest them. It took them in, and they worked out an arrangement. I'll provide you with ATP. You give me a nice warm home. And in the process, I'll ship most of my genes off to your nucleus. I'll keep a small set for the proteins that I have to produce as a specialized organelle. That was standard theory.
Sounds like a cellular love story here.
Well, it's definitely a story. I mean, there's definitely a narrative there about how these organelles came to be. But many evolutionary biologists are skeptical of the story, and they're skeptical for lots of reasons, one of which, there appears to be no prokaryote that can do this. We've never observed a prokaryote that has the ability to engulf another cell, which is, as far as we can tell, that engulfing process of extending your cell membrane around some other body and then incorporating it into yourself is something that eukaryotes do. You need a lot of cytoskeletal machinery and so forth to perform that function. So I just read a paper the other day by an author saying, Eugene Koonin is the author actually, saying, you know, this is kind of a gap in this narrative. The very step you need to get the bacterial cell into the other cell to set up shop seems to be missing.
And okay. Again, so we have a problem with whether or not these scenarios are consistent with the principle of continuity, don't we?
Exactly. What the skeptic or the critical evaluator of the scenario, the evolutionary pathway, says is, if I bring the rest of my biological knowledge to bear on your hypothesis, at this step here on this pathway, I see a place where the evidence is either missing or the evidence that we have bears against what you're saying. Continuity, meaning biological possibility, appears to be violated here. In other words, if you're going to claim that you got from A to B via this pathway, then every step on that pathway must be biologically possible. And at this point, I don't see any evidence that this particular part of the pathway is possible. So continuity acts as an independent umpire or referee on evolutionary hypotheses, and it's used, as I said a moment ago, everywhere. In fact, I think it's remarkable when someone begins to look at evolutionary theory with the principle of continuity in mind, they'll see just how prevalent and powerful it is.
Okay, well, I think this is a great introduction to your essay entitled Five Questions Everyone Should Ask About Common Descent, which is also a nice entree into that entire section of the book, which is a scientific critique of theistic evolution, really a scientific critique of any sort of evolution that calls for common descent leading up to humans. Now, I would like to wrap this up, Paul, with an invitation for you to come back and talk about your second essay another time that has to do with methodological naturalism, which you mentioned a little bit earlier. But for the sake of continuity here, let's just ask our listeners to, in the meantime, go to Amazon.com, simply type in theistic evolution. I just tried it. And the first book that pops up, guess what book it is, Paul?
I think I know.
The book that you're in that we've been talking about, whose full title is Theistic Evolution, A Scientific, Philosophical, and Theological Critique with Crossway Books. I'm Mike Keyes with ID the Future. Thank you for joining us. And Paul, we look forward to talking with you soon.
Thanks for having me.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.